Chapter 20. There was a sailor who had been there upwards of 11 years, and who in a few months' time would be free. 11 years of solitary confinement. I am very glad to hear your time is nearly out. Apostrophe. What does he say? Nothing. Why does he stare at his hands, and pick the flesh upon his fingers, and raise his eyes for an instant, every now and then, to those bare walls which have seen his head turn gray? It is a way he has sometimes. Does he never look men in the face, and does he always pluck at those hands of his, as though he were bent on parting skin and bone? It is his humor. Nothing more. It is his humor to say that he does not look forward to going out, that he is not glad the time is drawing near, that he did look forward to it once, but that was very long ago, that he has lost all care for everything. It is his humor to be a helpless, crushed, and broken man. And, heaven be his witness, that he has his humor thoroughly gratified. There were 3 young women in adjoining cells, all convicted at the same time of a conspiracy to rob their prosecutor. In the silence and solitude of their lives they had grown to be quite beautiful. Their looks were very sad, and might have moved the sternest visitor to tears, but not to that kind of sorrow which the contemplation of the men awakens. One was a young girl, not 20, as I recollect, whose snow-white room was hung with the work of some former prisoner, and upon whose downcast face the sun in all its splendor shone down through the high chink in the wall, where one narrow strip of bright blue sky was visible. She was very penitent and quiet, had come to be resigned, she said, and I believe her, and had a mind at peace. In a word, you are happy here? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said one of my companions. She did struggle very hard to answer, yes, but raising her eyes, and meeting that glimpse of freedom overhead, she burst into tears, and said, she tried to be, she uttered no complaint, but it was natural that she should sometimes long to go out of that one cell. She could not help that, apostrophe, she sobbed, poor thing. I went from cell to cell that day, and every face I saw, or word I heard, or incident I noted, is present to my mind in all its painfulness. But let me pass them by, for one, more pleasant, glance of a prison on the same plan which I afterwards saw at Pittsburgh. When I had gone over that, in the same manner, I asked the governor if he had any person in his charge who was shortly going out. He had one, he said, whose time was up next day, but he had only been a prisoner 2 years. 2 years. I looked back through 2 years of my own life out of jail, prosperous, happy, surrounded by blessings, comforts, good fortune, and thought how wide a gap it was, and how long those 2 years passed in solitary captivity would have been. I have the face of this man, who was going to be released next day, before me now. It is almost more memorable in its happiness than the other faces in their misery. How easy and how natural it was for him to say that the system was a good one, and that the time went pretty quick considering, apostrophe, and that when a man once felt that he had offended the law and must satisfy it, he got along, somehow, and so forth. What did he call you back to say to you, in that strange flutter? Apostrophe, apostrophe, I asked of my conductor, when he had locked the door and joined me in the passage. Oh, that he was afraid the soles of his boots were not fit for walking, as they were a good deal worn when he came in, and that he would thank me very much to have them mended, ready. Apostrophe, those boots had been taken off his feet, and put away with the rest of his clothes, 2 years before. I took that opportunity of inquiring how they conducted themselves immediately before going out, adding that I presumed they trembled very much. Well, it's not so much a trembling, apostrophe, was the answer, though they do quiver, as a complete derangement of the nervous system. They can't sign their names to the book, sometimes can't even hold the pen, look about them without appearing to know why or where they are, and sometimes get up and sit down again, 20 times in a minute. This is when they are in the office, where they are taken with the hood on, as they were brought in. When they get outside the gate, they stop, and look first one way, and then the other, not knowing which to take. Sometimes they stagger, as if they were drunk, and sometimes are forced to lean against the fence, they are so bad. But they clear off in course of time. Apostrophe, as I walked among these solitary cells, and looked at the faces of the men within them, I tried to picture to myself the thoughts and feelings natural to their condition. I imagined the hood just taken off, and the scene of their captivity disclosed to them in all its dismal monotony. At first, the man is stunned. His confinement is a hideous vision, and his old life a reality. He throws himself upon his bed, and lies there abandoned to despair. By degrees the insupportable solitude and barrenness of the place rouses him from this stupor, and when the trap in his grated door is opened, he humbly begs and prays for work. Give me some work to do, or I shall go raving mad. Apostrophe, apostrophe, he has it, and by fits and starts applies himself to labor. But every now and then there comes upon him a burning sense of the years that must be wasted in that stone coffin, and an agony so piercing in the recollection of those who are hidden from his view and knowledge, that he starts from his seat, and striding up and down the narrow room with both hands clasped on his uplifted head, hears spirits tempting him to beat his brains out on the wall. Again he falls upon his bed, and lies there, moaning. Suddenly he starts up, wondering whether any other man is near, whether there is another cell like that on either side of him, and listens keenly. There is no sound, but other prisoners may be near for all that. He remembers to have heard once, when he little thought of coming here himself, that the cells were so constructed that the prisoners could not hear each other, though the officers could hear them. Where is the nearest man upon the right, or on the left, or is there one in both directions? Where is he sitting now with his face to the light, or is he walking to and fro? How is he dressed? Has he been here long? Is he much worn away? Is he very white and specter-like? Does he think of his neighbor too? Scarcely venturing to breathe, and listening while he thinks, he conjures up a figure with his back towards him, and imagines it moving about in this next cell. He has no idea of the face, but he is certain of the dark form of a stooping man. In the cell upon the other side, he puts another figure, whose face is hidden from him also. Day after day, and often when he wakes up in the middle of the night, he thinks of these two men until he is almost distracted. He never changes them. There they are always as he first imagined them, an old man on the right, a younger man upon the left whose hidden features torture him to death, and have a mystery that makes him tremble. The weary days pass on with solemn pace, like mourners at a funeral. And slowly he begins to feel that the white walls of the cell have something dreadful in them, that their color is horrible, that their smooth surface chills his blood, that there is one hateful corner which torments him. Every morning when he wakes, he hides his head beneath the coverlet, and shudders to see the ghastly ceiling looking down upon him. The blessed light of day itself peeps in, an ugly phantom face, through the unchangeable crevice which is his prison window. By slow but sure degrees, the terrors of that hateful corner swell until they beset him at all times, invade his rest, make his dreams hideous, and his nights dreadful. At first, he took a strange dislike to it, feeling as though it gave birth in his brain to something of corresponding shape, which ought not to be there, and racked his head with pains. Then he began to fear it, then to dream of it, and of men whispering its name and pointing to it. Then he could not bear to look at it, nor yet to turn his back upon it. Now, it is every night the lurking place of a ghost, a shadow, a silent something, horrible to see, but whether bird, or beast, or muffled human shape, he cannot tell. When he is in his cell by day, he fears the little yard without. When he is in the yard, he dreads to re-enter the cell. When night comes, there stands the phantom in the corner. If he have the courage to stand in its place and drive it out, he at once. being desperate, it broods upon his bed. In the twilight, and always at the same hour, a voice calls to him by name. As the darkness thickens, his loom begins to live, and even that, his comfort, is a hideous figure, watching him till daybreak. Again, by slow degrees, these horrible fancies depart from him one by one, returning sometimes, unexpectedly, but at longer intervals, and in less alarming shapes. He has talked upon religious matters with the gentleman who visits him, and has read his Bible, and has written a prayer upon his slate, and hung it up as a kind of protection, and an assurance of heavenly companionship. He dreams now, sometimes, of his children or his wife, but is sure that they are dead, or have deserted him. He is easily moved to tears, is gentle, submissive, and broken-spirited. Occasionally, the old agony comes back. A very little thing will revive it, even a familiar sound, or the scent of summer flowers in the air, but it does not last long now. For the world without has come to be the vision, and this solitary life, the sad reality. If his term of imprisonment be short, I mean comparatively, for short it cannot be, the last half year is almost worse than all. For then he thinks the prison will take fire, and he be burned in the ruins, or that he is doomed to die within the walls, or that he will be detained on some false charge and sentenced for another term. Or that something, no matter what, must happen to prevent his going at large. And this is natural, and impossible to be reasoned against, because, after his long separation from human life, and his great suffering, any event will appear to him more probable in the contemplation, than the being restored to liberty, and his fellow creatures. If his period of confinement have been very long, the prospect of release bewilders and confuses him. His broken heart may flutter for a moment, when he thinks of the world outside, and what it might have been to him in all those lonely years, but that is all. The cell door has been closed too long on all its hopes and cares. Better to have hanged him in the beginning than bring him to this pass, and send him forth, to mingle with his kind, who are his kind no more. On the haggard face of every man among these prisoners, the same expression sat. I know not what to liken it to. It had something of that strained attention which we see upon the faces of the blind and deaf, mingled with a kind of horror, as though they had all been secretly terrified. In every little chamber that I entered, and at every grate through which I looked, I seemed to see the same appalling countenance. It lives in my memory, with the fascination of a remarkable picture. Parade before my eyes, 100 men, with one among them newly released from this solitary suffering, and I would point him out. The faces of the women, as I have said, it humanizes and refines. Whether this be because of their better nature, which is elicited in solitude, or because of their being gentler creatures, of greater patience and longer suffering, I do not know, but so it is. That the punishment is nevertheless, to my thinking, fully as cruel, and as wrong in their case, as in that of the men, I need scarcely add. My firm conviction is that, independent of the mental anguish it occasions, an anguish so acute and so tremendous, that all imagination of it must fall far short of the reality, it wears the mind into a morbid state, which renders it unfit for the rough contact and busy action of the world. It is my fixed opinion that those who have undergone this punishment must pass into society again morally unhealthy and diseased. There are many instances on record of men who have chosen, or have been condemned, to lives of perfect solitude, but I scarcely remember one, even among sages of strong and vigorous intellect, where its effect has not become apparent in some disordered train of thought or some gloomy hallucination. What monstrous phantoms, bred of despondency and doubt, and born and reared in solitude, have stalked upon the earth, making creation ugly, and darkening the face of heaven. Suicides are rare among these prisoners. Are almost, indeed, unknown. But no argument in favor of the system can reasonably be deduced from this circumstance, although it is very often urged. All men who have made diseases of the mind their study know perfectly well that such extreme depression and despair as will change the whole character and beat down all its powers of elasticity and self-resistance may be at work within a man and yet stop short of self-destruction. This is a common case. That it makes the senses dull and by degrees impairs the bodily faculties, I am quite sure. I remarked to those who were with me in this very establishment at Philadelphia that the criminals who had been there long were deaf. They, who were in the habit of seeing these men constantly, were perfectly amazed at the idea, which they regarded as groundless and fanciful. And yet the very first prisoner to whom they appealed, one of their own selection, confirmed my impression, which was unknown to him, instantly, and said, with a genuine air it was impossible to doubt, that he couldn't think how it happened, but he was growing very dull of hearing. That it is a singularly unequal punishment, and affects the worst man least, there is no doubt. In its superior efficiency as a means of reformation, compared with that other code of regulations which allows the prisoners to work in company without communicating together, I have not the smallest faith. All the instances of reformation that were mentioned to me were of a kind that might have been, and I have no doubt whatever, in my own mind, would have been equally well brought about by the silent system. With regard to such men as the Negro burglar and the English thief, even the most enthusiastic have scarcely any hope of their conversion. It seems to me that the objection that nothing wholesome or good is ever at its growth in such unnatural solitude, and that even a dog or any of the more intelligent among beasts would pine and mope and rust away beneath its influence, would be in itself a sufficient argument against this system. But when we recollect, in addition, how very cruel and severe it is, and that a solitary life is always liable to peculiar and distinct objections of a most deplorable nature, which have arisen here, and call to mind, moreover, that the choice is not between this system and a bad or ill-considered one, but between it and another which has worked well, and is, in its whole design and practice, excellent. There is surely more than sufficient reason for abandoning a mode of punishment attended by so little hope or promise, and fraught, beyond dispute, with such a host of evils. As a relief to its contemplation, I will close this chapter with a curious story arising out of the same theme, which was related to me, on the occasion of this visit, by some of the gentlemen concerned. At one of the periodical meetings of the inspectors of this prison, a working man of Philadelphia presented himself before the board, and earnestly requested to be placed in solitary confinement. On being asked what motive could possibly prompt him to make this strange demand, he answered that he had an irresistible propensity to get drunk, that he was constantly indulging it, to his great misery and ruin. That he had no power of resistance, that he wished to be put beyond the reach of temptation, and that he could think of no better way than this. It was pointed out to him, in reply. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.